Versa Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump told an audience of law enforcement officials his January 27 executive order restricting entry of people from seven countries is clear and lawful, and warned the nation's security could be at risk.
It was done for the security of our nation, the security of our citizens, so that people come in who aren't going to do us harm. And that's why it was done. And it couldn't have been written any more precisely. It's not like, oh, gee, we wish it were written better. Was written beautifully.
Mr. Trump took aim at the federal courts, which for now have halted that order's implementation.
When you read something so perfectly written and so clear to anybody, and then you have lawyers and I watched last night in amazement, and I heard things that I couldn't believe. Things that really had nothing to do with what I just read. And I don't ever want to call a court biased, so I won't call it biased. And we haven't had a decision yet. But courts seem to be so political.
A federal appeals court said it will likely rule this week whether a federal judge had the legal ground to suspend the ban. It's also grappling with the extent of the president's authority, whether the order violates the Constitution's prohibition against favoring one religion over another. The case could end up before the Supreme Court. Somali lawmakers elected a new president Wednesday, choosing former Prime Minister Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, a dual U.S. Somali citizen. Electoral Commission Chairman Abdirahman Bale called it a happy day, heralding a new state and history, called for unity behind the country's new leader. Mohamed declared the winner after two rounds of voting by the Somali parliament under tight security at the city's airport. He pledged to improve security against the Al-Shabaab insurgency, fight corruption, and assist the poor. This is VOA News. The top U.S. commander in Iraq said he believes U.S.-backed forces will be able to wrest control of Islamic State's last urban strongholds, Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq.
We take away their two capitals, their Iraqi capital of Mosul and their Syrian capital of Raqqa, they're not going to really be able to claim that they have a physical caliphate anymore.
Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend cautioning that doesn't mean the defeat of the Islamic State. He said they'll still be around and change their nature. The U.S. Defense Department has been directed by President Trump to come up with a plan to accelerate the campaign against the IS group. Meanwhile, the Pentagon said two airstrikes it carried out killed 11 al-Qaeda operatives near the northwest Syrian city Idlib this month, including one with ties to deceased militant mastermind Osama bin Laden. Turkey Wednesday claimed that Syrian rebels it backs captured the outskirts of the IS-held town of El Bab in northern Syria. Meanwhile, airplanes, likely Syrian or Russian, bombed rebel-held parts of the city of Homs in the country's west, killing at least eight people. The UN Wednesday appealed for more than $2 billion in relief aid for Yemen. It warned that 11 million people are under the threat of famine and war. Stephen O'Brien heads the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
Humanitarian access in Yemen is severely limited due to fighting and bureaucratic impediments. To the parties to the conflict, I remind them that granting rapid and unimpeded humanitarian access is a key obligation under international humanitarian law.
He spoke during a donors' conference in Geneva, focused on the desperate need for food and shelter for millions in the impoverished nation caught in the midst of a two-year conflict. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has accused the Kremlin of trying to prevent him from taking part in next year's presidential election after he was handed a five-year suspended sentence following an embezzlement conviction. Pointing out the wording of the Russian Constitution, Navalny said all those not in prison have a right to take part in the election. He said for now he's not in prison. Navalny maintains his innocence, said he would appeal the sentence and would still run for president against Vladimir Putin, who has not indicated whether he seeks another term. The Russian embassy in Nigeria said seven Russians and a Ukrainian were kidnapped by armed pirates from a cargo ship in Nigerian waters. It didn't indicate when that occurred, but Nigerian authorities have been asked for assistance in locating the sailors of the BBC Caribbean, a Dutch-owned ship. In Central African Republic, a militia leader and pastor were among at least five people killed in violence in the capital's flashpoint PK5 neighborhood. More than two dozen were wounded following a joint military operation by UN peacekeepers and local troops to question a militia leader, Yusuf Malinga, known as Big Man, when his gunmen opened fire on security forces. On Wall Street, the NASDAQ Composite Index eked out another record close Wednesday. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Somalia has a new president.
The new elected president of Somalia, Mohamed Abdullahi Farmaajo, is a charismatic leader who will lead Somalia into a successful recovery. And also he will be an excellent in fighting Al-Shabaab.
Abdi Hakim Mohamed Faki is a former Somali defense minister. A Zimbabwe court dismisses a suit accusing President Mugabe of violating the constitution. UN peacekeepers arrive in the Kakoji area of South Sudan's Yei River State, and officials shut down Swaziland's Southern African Nazarene University due to student protests.
The students were starting to be violent. They demonstrated and they became so violent. So that's why management decided to close the institution to protect the property and infrastructure.
Sonibor Mamba is the Dean of Student Affairs at the Swaziland's Southern African Nazarene University, and a U.S. federal court considers the legality of President Donald Trump's controversial travel ban. Those stories, plus our Black History Month facts and contest, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Somali lawmakers yesterday elected a former prime minister who is a dual U.S.-Somali citizen as the country's new president. Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, better known as Farmaajo, was declared the winner after two rounds of voting by the Somali parliament in Mogadishu. He defeated incumbent leader Hassan Sheikh Mohamud and former president Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmed. Farmaajo, who is 54, has spent much of his adult life in the U.S. city of Buffalo, where he raised a family and held various jobs in the New York state government. But he maintained contact with Somali politics and served 8 months as Somali prime minister during 2010 and 2011. Abdi Hakim Mohamed Faki served under Farmaajo as defense minister and has known the new president for over 30 years. He says Mr. Farmaajo is the right person for the job to take on Al-Shabaab and revive the country's economy.
The new elected president of Somalia, Mohamed Abdullahi Farmaajo, I have known him for more than 30 years. And he's a patriotic, really, and he's a hard worker, he's a visionary leader, he's a charismatic leader who will lead Somalia into a successful recovery. And also he will be an excellent in fighting Al-Shabaab and international terrorism, and also he's good governance.
Why is he different, and how is he different from the other president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, Sheikh Sharif, Abdullah Yusuf, and why do you think he can succeed where they failed?
He is very different from the other leaders. The other leaders has been also done a good job, but what he differs from the other leaders is enjoys the overwhelmingly support of the Somali people. So that it will be easy, you know, to lead the country. And also at this time, Somalia is in a war with Al-Shabaab, against Al-Shabaab and international terrorism. And the Somali population and the government needed to work together very closely in order to defeat Al-Shabaab. So he is the one who can do that. According to his record, when he was the prime minister for 7 months, really, he shown his government a good governance and, the rule of law. And, he's far from tribalism also.
So you worked with him. Tell us exactly where you worked with him and tell us a bit about his personality.
I was a member of his cabinet as a deputy prime minister and minister of defense. For that important position, I had a very close working relationship with him day and night. And before that, even we used to work together in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs during Siad Barre's time. So what I believe is really he's the right leader for Somalia. He's a charismatic leader. He also very hardworking. He is honest. He is loyal to his country. So I believe that he will fight the Al-Shabaab, and I will also fight in the system against corruption, which is chronic, really, disease in the Somali government system.
Abdi Hakim Mohamed Faki is a former Somali defense minister. He was speaking with Haroon Maruf of the U.S. Somali Service. Officials of the Southern African Nazarene University in Manzini, Swaziland, are holding talks with members of the Student Representative Council to find ways of resolving their concerns, which led to the indefinite closure of the university. The university was closed after the students accused the school of increasing tuition fees without proper notification and withdrawing lodging allowance. The students then violently protested against what they said were inadequate allowances and poor facilities. To learn more about the closure of the university, VOA's Peter Clotter spoke with Sonny Boy Mamba, Dean of Student Affairs at the Southern African Nazarene University, about exactly what led to the university closure.
The students were starting to be violent. They demonstrated and they became so violent. So that's why management decided to close the institution to protect the property and infrastructure.
Some of the students were saying they petitioned the university authorities, but some of their concerns have yet to be addressed and that the university authorities have so far failed to address them. Do you think their concerns and their accusations are justified?
Yeah, in fact, there are some concerns by the students, and I'm very sorry to say management has tried to address the problems, but some of the problems are difficult because they actually need a third party. The third party is the government of Swaziland, which is actually paying scholarship for the students. So now we find that management was dealing with the issues, and some of the issues, they need consultations with the government of Swaziland, of which the students actually put a deadline that is nearer, so management could not go to actually talk with the Minister of Education.
So what were some of the key problems that the authorities on their own at the university wouldn't be able to solve, which you said needed consultations from the government? What were some of the specific issues?
The most issue is the issue of the tuition fee. They say the tuition fee is so high, the student cannot afford. Even the government is not able to pay the whole fee. So what is happening is when the allowance comes from the sponsor, the university will deduct the money from that so that they pay the discrepancy between what is paid by the government in terms of the tuition and what is being requested by management, by the administration.
We understand that the students also complain about there not being appropriate materials or sufficient materials for them to study.
That one, I can assure you that there is no problem like that one. We are trying our best. The equipment is there and everything is there. I think that one is not justified. That is not a concern that is justified.
What is next now for the university to do?
We are just waiting for Senate to decide, because it's Senate who decide to close university. As management, you cannot just open university. We need to a directive from the Senate, which is the highest body. So we're waiting for them to decide on that stage. Right? The Senate is the one that is governing the university. So whatever decision is taken, there is a directive from the Senate that will direct the management to close the institution.
So are there any further consultations going on with management or perhaps with the student body?
Yes, we are trying our best. Today we are having a meeting with the Minister of Social Welfare, the Labour and Social Welfare, and then we had a meeting with the management as well as the student board, the student SRC, the student committee that is representing the students. So I'm trying to sort out the differences. Yeah, I think there is progress because we are still in talks with the students. I think something will come out as prompt as possible.
One of the complaints of the student body is that the university raised some of the fees without alerting them. The fees they describe as exorbitant.
What is happening here is the students, they are sponsored by the government of Swaziland. What is happening here, at SAN, we are having our own fee structure. Then each and every year, we actually give the students the current fee structure and we bill government their sponsor so that the government could pay for the students. And what is happening here, each and every year, government is paying the same amount of money, yet the university has increased the fees. So now who is going to pay the discrepancy now? The students have to pay. In this case, because the students are sponsored by government is supposed to pay in this aspect. So that is a genuine issue here.
Sonny Bob Mamba is Dean of Student Affairs at the Southern African Nazarene University in Swaziland. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from Manzini, Swaziland. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 9th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's highest court has dismissed a case filed by an activist who argued that President Robert Mugabe violated the constitution and is therefore unfit for office. Sebastian Mofu has the latest from the courthouse in Harare.
Robert Mugabe has led Zimbabwe since independence in 1980, but the 92-year-old president has faced mounting calls to step down. Protests erupted last year over human rights abuses as the economy sank to new lows. Opposition activist Promise Mkwananzi filed a court petition alleging the president failed to uphold the constitution during the unrest. In his complaint, Mkwananzi cited cases where Mugabe threatened the judiciary and activists and said he personally owns the security forces. The Constitutional Court threw out the case Wednesday. The court said the president had not been served with the papers. Mukwananzi's lawyer, Kudzai Kadzere, told VOA the sheriff was paid but failed to do his duty.
I feel that this is a very important case for our local jurisprudence and it must be heard on the merits, which is why we are going to file a fresh application.
A ruling from the Constitutional Court could trigger impeachment proceedings in Parliament, but on Wednesday, Mugabe's lawyer, Terence Hussein, shrugged off the case.
This tenure, his mandate has emanated from the people, from an election, and I hardly think the court would want to interfere with that unless they have very, very good grounds. And I don't think anyone has made out those grounds sufficiently enough.
Mukwananzi's organization, hashtag Tajamuka, which means we are fed up, says it will not turn down the heat. Member Morini Kademaunga was in the courtroom Wednesday.
It is not just Promise Mkwananzi, this is the president of Zimbabwe. I think when I looked at the application, read it, I concurred with his submissions. I believe that the president has flouted the constitution and really must be answerable in the matters that he raises. He will not be discouraged, hashtag Tajamuka will not be discouraged, and they'll file again and will be here in full support.
Hashtag Tajamuka is taking part in a current initiative known as 21 Days of Activism Zimbabwe, which is calling on Mugabe to forgo expensive birthday celebrations later this month. An official from the ruling ZANU-PF party told VOA the event will not be cancelled as Mugabe is revered as Zimbabwe's liberator. The party has begged Mugabe to run for another term in 2018. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
A team of peacekeepers with the United Nations mission in South Sudan, also known as AMIS, arrived in the greater Kajokiji area of Ye River State this week to assess the humanitarian situation and protect civilians who were terrorized by recent violence in the area. Tens of thousands have fled across the border into Uganda because of weeks of deadly fighting. Nabil Biajo reports from Juba.
Daniel Dickinson is the UNMISS spokesperson in Juba. He spoke to VOA from Juba International Airport just moments before traveling to Bantu. Dickinson says UNMISS peacekeepers are doing their job in Kajokiji, which is to protect civilians.
Peacekeepers from the mission arrived in Kajokiji in the south of the country on Sunday. Civilians have been fleeing the town due to insecurity. Peacekeepers patrolled at the airport and market areas and reported seeing just a handful of civilians, but otherwise they described the situation as relatively calm.
Bishop Emmanuel Murray of the Kajokiji Diocese of the Episcopal Church of Sudan and South Sudan says only about 200 civilians remain in the area. Bishop Murray says they stayed behind because they did not have the means to flee to Uganda, along the thousands of others who escaped violence in and around Kajokiji in recent weeks.
Those are all the people who cannot travel from there to the camps, and they don't have money to hire the lorry, so they choose to be behind.
Dickinson says the peacekeepers spent 3 days on the 75-mile-long Juba-Kajokiji road due to the several roadblocks that government forces erected along the way.
The peacekeepers were part of a long-duration patrol, which originated in Juba. Now, the head of UNMISS, David Shearer, said he was pleased the peacekeepers had reached Kajokiji, thanks to their persistence.
Aid workers have also been blocked from using the Juba-Kajukaji road, an issue that was raised in Juba at a meeting held by the head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, Festus Mogae.
Access by civilian population to humanitarian assistance has been routinely obstructed, with the United Nations reporting in December 2016 that it had recorded 100 incidents against humanitarian workers and aid convoys.
Dickinson says a separate contingent of experts is also in Kajukaji to investigate reports of human rights abuses in the area.
Tuesday morning, an UNMISS civilian team, including human rights, civil affairs, and gender representatives, also arrived in Kajukaji.
The United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, released a report this week saying refugees arriving into Uganda from Kajukaji continue to cite violence and indiscriminate killing of civilians, nightly attacks on homes, sexual violence, looting of livestock, and torture as their reasons for leaving South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
The fate of President Donald Trump's controversial executive order on immigration is in the hands of the U.S. federal court system and may eventually go to the Supreme Court. Trump's order, which suspended refugee admissions and temporarily banned entry to people from seven majority Muslim nations, was put on hold by a federal judge last week. Trump critics and defenders both see the legal battle now playing out as a key test of the president's executive authority under the Constitution and the rights of the judicial branch to hold the president accountable to the rule of law. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports.
For President Trump, the executive order tightening immigration is all about keeping Americans secure.
It was done for the security of our nation, the security of our citizens, so that people come in who aren't going to do us harm. And that's why it was done.
We are the resistance. Let us rise up.
But Trump's order sparked demonstrations around the country. Democrats complained the president was exceeding his power, including Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
We need Republicans to set aside partisan considerations in favor of doing what's best for the country.
Opponents say the immigration order is discriminatory and unconstitutional. But Trump may have history on his side when it comes to presidential action to regulate immigration, says legal expert Dan McLaughlin.
So, because the president is relying on authority that has been delegated to him by Congress, he also has very broad authority, whether you think his policy is wise or not, very broad authority to act within the law.
The federal courts will now decide if Trump has gone beyond his presidential authority in issuing his executive orders, says expert Paul Schiff Berman.
The issue, I think, is whether these executive orders go farther. And I think that they do, both in their scope and in the incredibly ill-considered way in which they've been issued.
Before turning to politics, Trump built a reputation as a dynamic businessman with a brand known internationally. But now, as president, dealing with the limits of executive authority and the checks supplied by Congress and the court system could prove to be a challenge, says American University expert James Thurber.
We have separation of powers in our democracy. It's slow, it's deliberative, it's transparent. As a businessman, he likes to say, you know, you're fired, or let's get this done, let's move ahead. Well, in a democracy, you can't do that. That's going to frustrate him.
A lower court ruling temporarily halting Trump's immigration order led to many happy scenes at airports as families were reunited. But it's likely the Supreme Court will have the last word on Trump's travel ban and on the issue of presidential authority in this case. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Fact for today, February 9th. On this day in 1944, African-American poet, novelist, and short story writer Alice Walker was born in Eatonton, Georgia, into a sharecropper family. Most of her writings talked about the lives of blacks in the South. In 1982, she published the novel The Color Purple, which won the Pulitzer Prize the following year. In 1985, the book was made into a movie starring Oprah Winfrey. Also on this day in 1906, African-American poet and novelist Paul Laurence Dunbar died. Dunbar was the son of a slave and extremely popular for his poems about slave life on southern plantations. Did you know that Gwendolyn Brooks was the first African-American to receive the Pulitzer Prize? She received the award in 1950 for her work in poetry. Born in 1917, Brooks published her first poem when she was only about 13 years old. She later served a year as consultant to the Library of Congress and taught creative writing at several colleges. And today in Black History, we want to tell you about the role Buffalo Soldiers play in the settlement of the American West. Buffalo Soldiers were members of the Black Army units that served in the American West. They got their name from the Indians or Native Americans that they fought against. Their curly hair and bravery reminded the Native Americans of the buffalo, which the Indians respected very highly. Buffalo soldiers were commanded by white officers, but they took pride in wearing their uniform and serving their country. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 9th. Congratulations to Albo Alakbo of Obanlikku Local Government Area of Cross River State, Nigeria, Lapoisio Julu of Capitol Building, Monrovia, Liberia, and Bayoki Tayo Santo of Juba, South Sudan. You are the winners of our February 8th question. Who is considered the first female African-American millionaire? The answer, Madam C.J. Walker. Now, here's our question for today, February 9th. Who is the first African-American woman to host a national television talk show? Once again, who is the first African-American woman to host a national television talk show? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica@voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United Nations envoy to Libya says Libyans must make 2017 the year of decisions and political breakthrough. Martin Kobler told the Security Council Wednesday those decisions should include forming a strong army and police force, the best way to use oil and gas revenues, and amending the political deal that put a Western-backed government back in Tripoli. Kobler said Islamic State no longer controls any Libyan territory, but is still a threat, and that the country is still at risk for terrorism. Somali lawmakers elected a new president Wednesday, choosing a former prime minister who is a dual U.S. Somali citizen. Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, better known as Farmajo, was declared the winner after two rounds of voting by the Somali parliament in Mogadishu. Farmajo won the largest share of votes in the second round, far outdistancing incumbent leader Hassan Sheikh Mohamud and former President Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmed. That's it for this Thursday, February 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Strike, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, Sawubona. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in this Sunday for a full hour of delicious African music. Discover and delight in urban and in traditional music from Mali, Nigeria, Kenya, Cameroon, Tanzania, Morocco, and Mozambique. This music mix is just finger-licking good. Don't miss it. this Sunday, 1500 and 2000 UTC, right here on Music Time in Africa. Yum!